And, you know, business owners are fed up. And, you know, quite frankly, people can't afford fast food. $20 an hour minimum wage is only going to equal a $20 an hour, a $20 Big Mac for everybody.
Are you sure about that? Are you sure about that, California business lobbyist Tom Manzo? Or are you just making it up for Fox News?
I don't know why I came here tonight.
He's making it up.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
But Fox is glad to hear it.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
We'll discuss.
And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast. That's heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. Also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP. Rochester, New York's WRFZ. Down in New Orleans on WHIV. Out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ. Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN. Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ. In Seattle on KODX. Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR. Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR. And Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950. KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internet. So the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, an all-around swell fellow, says me. Oh, and California fast food eater, says me. From bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. Coming up a bit later in this hour, we will be joined by a Pulitzer Prize-winning economic journalist who is calling BS on an extraordinary lie being told by several Rupert Murdoch-owned media outlets and an industry group out here known as the California Business and Industrial Alliance, headed up by that guy you heard at the top of the show there, Tom Manzo, who are all claiming that a new California law requiring a $20 an hour minimum wage for fast food workers at places like McDonald's and Burger King is just devastating the state's fast food industry and resulting in thousands of job cuts across the state for those who work there. And those groups have statistics to prove it. Trouble is, those statistics, as it turns out, are all knowing lies, as business reporter Michael Hiltzik of the LA Times will be here to explain. In fact, fast food employment has gone up since California Governor Gavin Newsom's assigned the wage increase last September.
You mean Murdoch-owned news properties are saying one thing, but the reality is something completely different? What?
I know. Prepare to be shocked. That's coming up in a bit. Also, we've been reporting, we'll have some reported results out of some primary elections that were held on Tuesday in Virginia, Oklahoma, and Georgia in a moment. But we have been reporting of late on the record heat wave that is now sort of stuck above much of the nation, from Texas up through the Midwest and all the way to the East Coast, where it is expected to hang oppressively for a whole bunch of days now. And we've discussed the fires that exploded out west here in California, but that is not the only state grappling with an early wildfire season this year. Cooler weather and the chance of rain could bring some relief, but also the risk of danger this week to firefighters battling blazes in southern New Mexico that killed at least one person so far, damaged hundreds of structures, and forced thousands to evacuate. Strong wind pushed the larger of two fires into the mountain village of Ruidoso, forcing residents to flee immediately with little notice on Monday on
when
social.
When they say little notice, it was 5 minutes. Do not collect your stuff. Yeah. Get out now.
Yeah, go now was what they were saying in social media posts. Evacuate immediately. As of Wednesday, Weather patterns now were said to be shifting with moisture from a tropical wave in the Gulf of Mexico, which I will get to in a moment. The two large fires in New Mexico, meanwhile, remained at 0% containment as of midday on Wednesday, as crews used heavy equipment to build fire lines while water and retardant was dropped from the air. Officials said about 254 firefighters were on the scene. More personnel from departments around the region were continuing to arrive throughout Wednesday. Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham's office confirmed one fatality so far as a result of the fire, but said they had no further details. About 1,400 structures, however, have been destroyed or damaged. It's unclear at this hour how many of them were homes versus businesses. About 1,500 horses that were stabled at the Ruidoso Downs racetrack were moved in what is being described as a chaotic scene after authorities ordered that they be evacuated for the animals' safety. Meteorologist in the National Weather Service's Albuquerque office on Wednesday said, quote, the potential for scattered to isolated thunderstorms could help, but it will depend on where they hit. If the rain misses the fires, downward winds could cause problems for firefighters on the ground, making things even worse. He said the rain could also lead to dangerous flash flooding in newly burned areas in the mountainous region. So we've got a lot of listeners in New Mexico. Please be careful out there wherever you may be.
Yes.
Nationwide fire wildfires have scorched more than 3,200 square miles so far this year, a figure higher than the 10-year averages, according to the National Interagency Fire Center. About 20 wildfires currently burning are considered large and uncontained, including blazes in California and Washington State, in addition to New Mexico. So, as I said, be careful out there. As to that tropical wave in the Gulf of Mexico that may have an effect on the fires in New Mexico, Desi, you have been reporting for several months now that climate scientists have been warning of the likelihood of a busier than usual and a more intense than usual hurricane season this year.
Yes.
Particularly given the fact that thanks to climate change caused mainly by the man-made burning of fossil fuels, the waters in the Atlantic and the Gulf of Mexico in May, as I recall you reporting it, were already as warm as they would usually be in the month of August. Among scientists' predictions was that we were likely to see more named storms and more major hurricanes than usual this year. And, well, A is for Alberto. So we've got a first one as of Wednesday. It spun up very quickly, it seems, to tropical storm levels. And it seems to now be gunning for parts of Texas and Mexico.
Oh, yes, it certainly does. And yeah, it does look like it's going to be a doozy of an Atlantic hurricane season if Alberto's quick spin up is any indication. It is forecast to make landfall in northern Mexico early Thursday morning. And what's important to remember about this is that the rain is going to be the biggest part of this story. Forecast as much as 5 to 10 inches of rain along the southern South Texas as the storm continues to make its way after it makes landfall. And that means that it's also going to have the possibility of generating tornadoes and even possibly higher totals of rainfall than 10 inches in some locations, which could result in mudslides and flash flooding, especially in mountainous areas around northern Mexico. Now, the National Weather Service says the main hazard for southern coastal Texas is flooding from the excessive rain. There's also storm surge that is already affecting the South Texas coast. I should say the entire Texas coast, because we're seeing flooding and storm surge already affecting places like Surfside, Texas, which is actually near Galveston, Texas. They're already seeing
your old haunt.
Yes, it is. In fact, I used to go to Surfside, Texas for spring break in college, and I saw the videos from Wednesday showing up to 2 feet of water already going over some of the roads, making them impassable. It's really kind of shocking, and I think that people should make sure that they are ready for this hurricane season, because there's not going to be a whole lot of time to prepare when we see these the rapid intensification of these storms before making landfall.
And we should note here, by the way, this is still a tropical storm versus a hurricane, but really the only difference is wind speed. They can still carry as much moisture, you know, bringing these just torrential downpours and flooding. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Because remember, we saw that in Florida, a no-name storm earlier in June dumped more than 20 inches of rain on parts of South Florida.
That wasn't even a tropical storm.
It was just a regular storm.
Yeah.
And so that's what we need to be prepared for. It's a great idea now to make sure that you are ready for not just hurricane season, but for extreme weather season.
So, yeah, because here we go. Heat, wildfires, and now tropical storms. It is going to get rough over the next few weeks and months, I suspect. So please stay safe out there. Thank you, Des. As to the elections I mentioned, where Americans actually have the chance to, elect officials who might actually do something about all of this by taking action to mitigate our worsening climate crisis at the very least, as Joe Biden and the Democrats at least have done in recent months and years. Thank you. Despite continuing obstruction by Republicans and now a presumptive presidential nominee who has promised big fossil fuel donors that he will literally reverse everything that Joe Biden has done for climate over the past 4 years. Well, got that out of my system a little. Voters took to the polls for congressional primaries on Tuesday in Oklahoma and Virginia, and for primary runoff elections in Georgia. So far, no reported problems of note at the polling place for either voters at the polls on Tuesday or in the tabulation since polls closed. There's always a big but. Depending on how things go over the next few hours, that could change, as one of the most closely watched races on Tuesday is now apparently one of the closest races on Tuesday, with just over 300 votes currently reportedly separating these two Republican candidates in a race which, in truth, most political observers had expected to be kind of a blowout. One of America's farthest right Republican congressmen is now locked in a tight renomination battle against an even farther right opponent who was endorsed by former president and convicted felon Donald Trump, and also supported by former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy in Virginia's primary election on Tuesday. Congressman Bob Good, he chairs the hard right House Freedom Caucus. So he's very Trumpy. He's seeking a third term representing Virginia's 5th congressional district, but State Senator John McGuire has mounted a very strong challenge after Good had committed the apparent sin of endorsing Florida Governor Ron DeSantis for president during the presidential primaries, even though Good had said that he would support Trump after that contest was all but over. But that was not good enough, pardon the pun. He had to be destroyed, because that's the way Donald Trump rolls. So Trump endorsed an even Trumpier right-winger in McGuire to try and turf out Good. Adding to that, former House Speaker McCarthy was also gunning for Good because he was one of 8 Republicans who had voted to push McCarthy out as Speaker earlier this year. So spending on the election was wildly lopsided, with McGuire getting a ton more money to take on Good, the man that pretty much everyone in Washington seemed to have a reason to want to get rid of. If it was an Agatha Christie movie at the end, I think they would all have the motive. But apparently incumbency is a powerful thing these days. Good is putting up a better than good fight. Ballots remain to be counted still, and the close margin makes the race too early to call at this time. Virginia observes the Juneteenth holiday, according to AP, and so they are not expected to count votes on Wednesday as a result. But as of airtime, McGuire leads good, but only by about 300, well, by specifically 327 votes, or 0.52 percentage points. That out of about 62,495 ballots that were counted as of Wednesday. So McGuire was actually expected to clean up here. Well, now he's cleaning up, but only by about 300 votes, with a bunch left to still be counted, no matter who ultimately wins here. And by the way, do you suppose both of these election-denying candidates, in their case, will now suddenly find themselves in favor of, you know, counting all the mail-in ballots as long as it takes? Happily, Virginia now allows hand-marked paper ballots for all voters across the Commonwealth, so we should be able to figure out who actually won that race before all is said and done, if they're allowed to count the ballots. No matter who wins, the seat is likely to be carried by a Republican this fall in a very red district, but we will be keeping our eyes on that race and on the counting of those ballots. Meanwhile, Democrats in northern and central Virginia chose nominees to replace popular incumbents who are not seeking re-election. In House District 7, Eugene Vindman, the twin brother of Alexander Vindman, who you will recall for his courageous testimony during Donald Trump's first impeachment, calling Trump out for withholding aid to Ukraine unless Ukraine's president was willing to make up lies about Hunter Biden, Joe Biden's son. Eugene Vindman won a very crowded Democratic primary in that House district. He did crush everyone else in the fundraising race, however, so it's not unexpected. That in hopes of Democrats holding the seat that is being vacated by Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger. She is running for governor in 2025 in Virginia, while Republicans reportedly chose Derek Anderson to run on their side this November in what is considered a slightly safer seat for Democrats. District 7 has been a bit of a swing district in recent years, but in a slightly safer seat in the District 10, voters chose Suhas Subramaniam. I'm sure I'm getting that completely wrong, but that was from a field of 12 Democrats hoping to hold that seat held currently by U.S. Rep. Jennifer Wexton. She is not seeking re-election to her Northern Virginia seat after being diagnosed with a rare, incurable neurological illness. Republican voters, for their part, nominated Mike Clancy to run for that seat. Both of those districts could be competitive this fall and key for Democrats to hold if they hope to gain back a majority in the U.S. House next year. Statewide, voters selected the Trump-endorsed Hung Cao as the Republican nominee to the U.S. Senate to take on Democratic incumbent Tim Kaine, who is seeking his third term as the state's junior U.S. senator. But again, we will be keeping a close eye on that race in the fifth district up there between Bob Good and John McGuire. That could be fun. And finally, before we get to my guest today, and in another reminder of why this year's elections continue to be so important, Louisiana's Republican Governor Jeff Landry signed legislation on Wednesday requiring the display of the Ten Commandments in every single public classroom in the state, making it the only one with such a mandate and reigniting the debate over how porous the boundary between church and state should be, or in this case, should not be. Critics, including the ACLU and the Freedom From Religion Foundation, vowed a legal fight against the law that they deemed, quote, blatantly unconstitutional. But it's a battle that proponents are prepared and eager to take on now that they feel they have fully captured the U.S. Supreme Court with their packed, stolen, and corrupted far-right majority. Quote, I can't wait to be sued, said Governor Landry at a Republican fundraiser over the weekend. And on Wednesday, as he signed the measure, he argued, quote, if you want to respect the rule of law, you've got to start from the original lawgiver, which was Moses. Now, I'm no religious scholar, but my understanding was that those were Ten Commandments from God, not Moses. I don't want to quibble here, but that's my understanding. But I guess it's fun for a governor to play fast and loose with such things while requiring every student in the state to follow his commandment. The legislation is part of a broader campaign by right-wing Christians to amplify public expressions of faith and to provoke lawsuits in hopes of reaching the Supreme Court, where they expect a friendlier reception than in previous years. Charles Haynes, a senior fellow at the Freedom Forum and a scholar with an expertise in religious liberty and civil discourse, said that he found the enthusiasm behind the Louisiana law and other efforts to be unwarranted. The enthusiasm that they believe they're going to be able to get it through the Supreme Court. He says, quote, I think they are overreaching. He added that even this court will have a hard time justifying what lawmakers have conceived. Really? Will they? Because I don't think they will have any problem at all, but I will defer to the expert until we see how this goes. The measure in Louisiana requires that the commandments be displayed in each classroom of every public elementary, middle, and high school, as well as public college classrooms. Every classroom. The posters must be no smaller than 11 by 14 inches. The commandments must be, quote, the central focus of the poster, and in a large, easily readable font. It will also include a three-paragraph statement asserting that the Ten Commandments were a, quote, prominent part of American public education for almost three centuries. That even though the U.S. has only officially existed as a nation for about 250 years, but whatevs.
Math is hard.
It is. The quote, the Ten Commandments is there time and time again as the basis and foundation for the system that America was built on, said Matt Krause, a lawyer for the First Liberty Institute, a nonprofit legal group defending religious expression and hoping to get this up to the Supreme Court. Said State Rep. Dodie Horton, the Republican sponsor of the legislation, quote, given all the junk our children are exposed to in classrooms today, it's imperative that we put the Ten Commandments back in a prominent position. The measure allows for our children to look up and see what God says is right and what he says is wrong, she told colleagues. Here's a fun idea for those kids. To help teach that religious text in public schools. Let's ask those school kids if they can identify any commandment among those 10 that has not been repeatedly violated by the dude that Republicans are about to select to be their nominee for president of the United States next month. Think you can find one? Just one? Surely there must be at least one commandment that Trump has yet to violate, right? Critics of this said the legislation was a clear constitutional violation. In a joint statement, groups including the American Civil Liberties Union of Louisiana, the Americans United for Separation of Church and State, and the Southern Poverty Law Center argued that the law, quote, violates students' and families' fundamental right to religious freedom. Our public schools are not Sunday schools, the statement said, and students of all faiths or no faith should feel welcome in them. The law, as the New York Times notes, is a product of a legislative season in which Republican lawmakers in the state who had felt stifled for 8 years under a Democratic governor, John Bel Edwards, sought now to advance a flurry of far-right legislation to their new Republican governor, Landry, the successor to Bel Edwards. So this is what you get. In a special session this year, Republican lawmakers rolled back a previous overhaul of the criminal justice system. They passed bills to lengthen sentences for several offenses, to strictly limit access to parole, to prosecute 17-year-olds charged with any crime as adults, and to allow methods of execution beyond lethal injection. Because, you know, ain't that what Jesus would do? Lawmakers also advanced first-in-the-nation measures like designating abortion pills to be dangerous controlled substances, even though they are nothing of the sort, and to allow judges to order surgical castration. Surgical castration.
Not chemical castration, but
surgical castration of child sex offenders. Louisiana is the first state to enact a requirement for displaying the Ten Commandments in schools since the Supreme Court struck down a Kentucky law back in 1980 that had a similar directive. In that case, the court found that the law violated the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. But, you know, because the Supreme Court is comprised of so many of what people still call conservatives now, even though there was a conservative majority back in 1980 as well, but now they're going to try again so that those so-called conservatives can do stuff that, you know, conservatives do, like completely overturn precedents and completely change interpretations of the U.S. Constitution. You know, conservative. Mr. Haynes of the Freedom Forum said that he believed that the courts, including the Supreme Court, if the case gets there, would see through the statements about historical context and recognize that the motivation was, in fact, to inject religious teaching into public classrooms. We'll see if he's right about that. If the courts did not agree, he said, the result would amount to a catastrophic erosion in the divisions between government and religion. Quote, that would change who we are as a country to go in that direction and have no barrier to government entanglement with religion. What would be left, he asked. What couldn't the government do? Good question. And one that I have a feeling we may be learning an answer to very soon. With that said, from one of the most regressive states in the nation at this point, Louisiana, to one of the most progressive states, California, where right-wingers are working hard to make sure that workers do not enjoy a living wage, no matter how hard they work. And even if those right-wingers have to lie and lie and lie about it. Pulitzer Prize-winning business journalist and author Michael Hiltzik joins me next on the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
Hi, this is Desi Doyen from the Green News Report and the Bradcast. What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At the Bradcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Work your fingers to the bone. What do you get? Bony fingers. Bony fingers.
Well, hopefully you get more than that, at least out here in California these days. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Many of us woke, progressive, liberal leftists were celebrating last year when, at long last, California's Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom signed a measure in September that would raise the minimum wage for fast food workers here in the Golden State at nationally owned chain restaurants that have 60 or more stores from $16 an hour to $20 an hour. It would be good for hundreds of thousands of workers in the sector, good for the entire economy in California, given that so many workers would now have more money in their pockets to spend into the economy, floating all boats. Win-win all around, right? The bill was signed in September of last year, with wages set to go up for workers on April 1 of this year. But before that could even happen, according to the Wall Street Journal, the law was already a disaster, not just for owners of major fast food outlets across the state, but for thousands of workers who had already been laid off by those companies. Thanks to the new law, they simply couldn't afford those workers anymore at $20 an hour. As the Rupert Murdoch-owned Journal reported in late March this year, just days before California state law would actually take effect, California restaurants cut jobs as fast food wages set to rise. They note that some restaurants are already laying off staff and reducing hours for workers as they try to cut costs. California restaurants, they say, particularly pizza joints, have outlined plans to cut hundreds of jobs in the months leading up to the April 1 wage mandate, according to state records. Other operators said that they have halted hiring altogether or are scaling back workers' hours. Well, that sounds bad. A few months later, just a couple weeks ago in early June, after the law actually went into effect back in April, the Rupert Murdoch-owned New York Post followed up on the California fast food apocalypse to report how bad it has actually become. California fast food restaurants have slashed nearly 10,000 jobs because of the state's new $20 minimum wage, they say, as struggling franchises, including McDonald's and Burger King, according to the Post, cut labor costs and raise prices to survive. The California Business and Industrial Alliance, or CABIA, described by the Post as a major trade group, slammed Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom for pushing through the law, which went into effect April 1, and was blamed for forcing one beloved taco chain to shutter 48 locations in the state. According to the New York Post, CABIA president and founder Tom Manzo told Rupert Murdoch-owned Fox Business, quote, "California businesses have been under total attack and total assault for years." Well, I guess that's why there are so few fast food joints out here in California. I kid, of course, there is no shortage of them. Nonetheless, Manzo warned, quote, "It's just another law that puts business in further jeopardy." Manzo said nearly 10,000 jobs have been cut across the fast food restaurants since Newsom signed California Assembly Bill 1287 into law last year, adding that officials were living in a, quote, "fantasy land" by thinking that drastic wage increases will help workers or businesses. CABIA then took out a full-page ad in USA Today. Not the LA Times, mind you, or some other California paper, but the national USA Today that includes a mock obituary of popular fast food brands. "In memoriam," the ad notes in huge letters at the top of the page, "victims of Newsom's minimum wage." It goes on to say, in all caps, "California loses nearly 10,000 fast food jobs after $20 minimum wage signed last fall," before explaining that between last fall, when Newsom signed the measure, and this past January, quote, "California fast food restaurants cut about 9,500 jobs, representing a 1.3% change from September of 2023. They cited data, they said, was provided by the Hoover Institution in late April. Above photos of dozens of restaurant chain stores, from McDonald's to Burger King to El Pollo Loco to Subway to Pizza Hut to Cinnabon and more, all closed, I guess. They said they were being devastated by Newsom's mandate and being forced to both raise prices and fire workers. Way at the bottom of the full page ad in USA Today, we are told that It is from Cabia.org, and that the ad was paid for by the California Business and Industrial Alliance. The New York Post cites what it described as a recent survey conducted by LendingTree, finding that 78% of consumers now consider fast food to be a, quote, luxury purchase due to how expensive the meals have become. Part of the push for the hike, according to the paper, was to give fast food workers more financial freedom in a state known for its high cost of living. However, critics contend fast food jobs were meant for young people as a stepping stone. Quoting Manzo again from Cabia, the California Business and Industrial Alliance, quote, it's a starter industry, Manzo said. You get a job as a kid working in a fast food restaurant and you learn some good work ethic and that takes you into life, which, of course, ignores the thousands of workers in their 30s and 40s and 50s and older who have been working at such restaurants for decades. But still, if those workers are all going to be laid off, with 10,000 of them already laid off even before the law took effect this April, well, I guess this law is a bad one. And not only bad for California, apparently, but I guess given all the coverage in national outlets outside of California, it must be bad for workers elsewhere as well, just in case any of those pesky workers may get the idea in states other than liberal, woke California that they might also enjoy a living wage someday. Meanwhile, in an actual California newspaper, the Los Angeles Times last week, Pulitzer Prize-winning business reporter Michael Hiltzik reports, the fast food industry has been wringing its hands over the devastating impact on its businesses from California's new minimum wage law for its workers. Their raw figures certainly seem to bear that out. A full-page ad recently placed in USA Today by the California Business and Industrial Alliance asserted that nearly 10,000 fast food jobs had been lost in the state since Governor Gavin Newsom signed the law in September. But here's something you might want to know about this claim, writes Hiltzik. It's baloney. Sliced thick. In fact, he notes from September through January, the period covered by the ad, fast food employment in California has actually gone up, as tracked by no less than the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Federal Reserve. The claim that it has fallen represents a flagrant misrepresentation of government employment figures, writes Hiltzik. What? A misrepresentation of facts by Rupert Murdoch's Wall Street Journal and Rupert Murdoch's New York Post and Rupert Murdoch's Fox Business Channel and by the California Business and Industrial Alliance? Say it ain't so. Here to say it is so, I suspect, is Michael Hiltzik, longtime Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and business columnist for the LA Times, where he has served as a financial and political writer, an investigative reporter, a technology writer, an editor, a foreign correspondent, and he is the author of several books, including what I believe is his latest, Iron Empires, Robber Barons, Railroads, and the Making of Modern America. Mr. Hiltzik, welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
Well, thanks for having me. It's good to be back with you.
So, you know, there's the old saying, Michael, lies, damn lies, and statistics. You report that not only during the period covered by Cabia's full-page ad in USA Today in June, curiously, covering the period from September of last year until January of this year, that fast food employment in California actually went up. And in April of this year, after the new minimum wage actually went into effect, fast food establishment employment was actually higher by nearly 7,000 jobs than it was in April of 2023. So how can employment both be down, according to Cabia, and yet up, according to you and those slackers at the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics?
Right. Well, what we're dealing with here is the misuse of employment figures by essentially using non-seasonally adjusted figures rather than what we should be using, or what Cabia and the Wall Street Journal should be using, which is seasonally adjusted. And mm-hmm. I think a lot of your listeners have heard the term seasonally adjusted employment. And what that basically means is that when you have an industry in which employment fluctuates during the year for seasonal reasons, mm-hmm. you have to use seasonally adjusted figures. And that's because it's inaccurate to say employment rose or fell during some period of the year when what you are seeing is something, is a phenomenon that happens year after year. And that's the case with fast food restaurants and indeed almost all restaurants. It's well understood, everybody in the restaurant business knows this, that business is best for restaurants in sort of the March to September period. Mm-hmm. This is a time when you've got Mother's Day and Father's Day in the beginning of summer, mm-hmm. when people are going out to eat or getting their families together to go out to eat. And then and employment in restaurants peaks in September year after year after year, and then falls in January year after year after year because the holidays are over, people are tapped out. Mm-hmm. The weather breaks and they're not so inclined to go out of doors to eat anymore. And we know this. And in fact, in California, what happened between September 2023 and January 2024, which is the period that Cabia purports to say was affected by the signing of this law, in fact, employment unseasonally adjusted fell by about 9,500 jobs in the fast food sector. Mm-hmm. But that's what happens as summer turns to fall and we begin to see the beginning of winter year after year after year. So what you have to do when you have figures like this is compare it not 1 month to the next month or a few months later. You have to compare each month to the same month in other years. And that's why the Bureau of Labor Statistics says that, in fact, employment in the sector in California went up in late 2023 compared to 2022 and went up again in early 2024 compared to the same early period in 2023. And everybody knows, any economist knows that when you're dealing with these sorts of industries, you absolutely must use seasonally adjusted figures. The Wall Street Journal didn't seem to know this, even though they're supposed to be experts in finance and the economy. They didn't know it. And then those who followed their lead, including Lee Ohanian, who's a UCLA economist,
yeah.
who writes for the Hoover Institution, the conservative Hoover Institution, he didn't realize when he cited Wall Street Journal's figures, he didn't realize that they were not using seasonally adjusted figures. And he's a little embarrassed about it because I asked him about it. And he said, gee, I assumed they were seasonally adjusted. But if they're not, I'm going to call and ask them about it. And then I'll write another column for Hoover explaining the error.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, if he's embarrassed about it, I checked just before airtime. It does not look like his article at the Hoover Institution has actually been changed, corrected, or frankly, retracted at this point. And yet this allowed Cabia to put this ad in the USA Today, citing their numbers as coming from the Hoover Institution, this, you know, well-regarded think tank, rather than the numbers coming from the Wall Street Journal, owned by Rupert Murdoch, and apparently who did not bother to actually check these numbers. So just to underscore what you said, Michael, we always expect jobs in this industry, in the restaurant industry, to go down in the fall between September and the end of the year, January and so forth. So rather than saying, oh, the industry just lost a bunch of jobs, what we need to do is compare it year over year. So in April, when this law goes into effect this year, April 24, the best comparison is to April of 23 as far as jobs. And what you're saying is there's almost 10,000 more jobs in the fast food industry after the $20 wage has gone into effect this year than there was last year when it was only 16. Do I understand that correct?
Yeah, actually, there were 7,000 more jobs in what the BLS, or the Bureau of Labor Statistics, calls the limited service restaurant sector in California. 7,000 more jobs this past April after the minimum wage law went into effect over the previous year, which was April 2023, was months before Newsom signed the minimum wage bill. In fact, it was a little uncertain whether he would sign it, but he ultimately did. So that's the comparison you really need to use,
right?
Not sort of fabricated false comparison of September of 2023 to January of 2024. So look, you know, maybe the Wall Street Journal reporter made a mistake. Maybe she did or didn't, but certainly Cabia knows the truth of seasonal variations in restaurant employment, because that's the business they're in. So, I think maybe the Wall Street Journal made a mistake, but it sure looks as if Cabia lied.
And it looks like the, well, by the way, let me just support one of their claims here a bit. Cabia says, and then the New York Post and Fox Business all dutifully report, quote, that Rubio's California Grill, known for its fish tacos, closed 48 of its nearly 134 locations at the end of May. The first major chain to fall victim to the new law, they say. Well, that sounds bad, Michael. They had to close about a third of their locations because of Gavin Newsom's law. And who doesn't love Rubio's California fish tacos? your response to that?
Yeah, well, that's a completely fabricated notion. And in fact, it's contradicted by the actual numbers out of Rubio. I mean, Rubio had to declare bankruptcy a few weeks ago, and it had a final declaration as to what its finances were like. And what we find there is not that they were brought down all of a sudden by the need to pay their frontline workers $20 an hour. They were brought down by the fact that they came under the control of a private equity firm that did what private equity does for a living, which is that it saddled the company with a tremendous amount of debt so that the private equity firm could sort of cash out, you know, the money that it to buy Rubio's. You know, in 2020, when this private equity firm acquired Rubio's, Rubio's had no debt. No debt. Well, today, or at the time that it finally filed for bankruptcy, it had $72 million of debt.
So
what do you think is really causing Rubio's to be in financial trouble?
So it wasn't Gavin Newsom's law. It was private equity that did in Rubio's. And yet, that is cited in all of these articles. Oh, they're closing 48 stores across California thanks to Gavin Newsom. Now, all of this, it seems to me, Michael Hiltzik, has done its job. Just looking at the comments over at hoover.org, where this article has not been retracted. Matthew Lim says, democracy eats itself. Everyone, tell your California friends about this and stop voting for authoritarian tyrants like Newsom. Another guy says, named Art, I had my first burger and fries, no drink, just a burger and fries last night. I fell over with the $19 price. That's it for me. I'm 84 years old, live on a fixed income. Going out for a burger and fries once in a while has been a treat for me. Fine dining, no more. Thank you, Governor.
Yeah, well, all I can say is I doubt it. I mean, one burger and fries at a fast food restaurant doesn't cost $19. We know that. I mean, we've all been at the, you know, the drive-up windows of, unless you're not telling, you know, the whole story, it's not really a credible.
So, Michael, you know, we're a national show. We do not solely focus on California, even though this story would seem to be a California-centric story. But I note that all of these articles, with all of their completely misleading numbers and information about all of these job losses since raising the minimum wage for workers in California. They come from outlets like the Wall Street Journal and the New York Post and Fox Business, and an ad taken out not in the LA Times, but in USA Today. Am I being too conspiratorial here by noticing that this story has been nationalized by these companies for some reason to sort of send a warning perhaps to other states where low-wage workers might be, you know, thinking about trying to improve their working conditions? Am I leaning too far over my skis with that?
No, I think basically, you know, once again, this is what industry lobbyists do for a living. Yeah, they are trying to scare politicians in other states away from raising the minimum wage. And look, you know, the minimum wage in this state and across the country has barely budged until very recently from where it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago. I'm sure, you know, PR executives have gotten nice raises in all that time. So, yeah, basically they're fabricating facts and statistics to basically get their own way and, you know, keep doing what they're doing and protect their own profits. They don't care about the workers. You know, they'd be happy if the workers were making half as much. So, yeah, this is what's going on.
And I'm pretty sure a bunch of those companies have CEOs who have seen their salaries go way up in recent years. But the other reason I'm glad that you cover this, Michael, and that we're able to expand on it a bit here nationally is because this feels like to me one of those zombie lies that kind of exists forever if it is not rebutted and rebutted loudly and early. You know, anytime, for example, fast food workers in other states, you know, might get the idea that they too should be paid a living wage. Well, all we have to do now is cite the thousands of workers who were laid off when California did it, and it devastated the fast food industry across the state, you know, with few at that point likely to do the digging that you did to disprove this entire rotten tube of thickly sliced bologna, I guess.
Yeah, you know, there's, you know, another element to this, which is that there's sort of an assumption out there that raising the minimum wage costs jobs. And what you hear, you know, certainly, you know, some of the pushback that I got from my column was everybody knows that you raise the minimum wage, you know, people get laid off. Well, you know, it makes sense, doesn't it? And the answer to that is that there's no evidence for that. That studies, you know, over and over and over in all parts of the United States have shown that when the minimum wage is raised, there's virtually no employment effect. Maybe very small, but in most cases, there's no employment effect. People don't lose their jobs. And in fact, everybody is better off because the minimum wage workers get more money, and that pushes wages up across the entire spectrum. So this is a good thing. And, you know, and as I've said, you know, we haven't raised the federal minimum wage, which is $7.25 an hour.
Yeah.
In, you know, 15 years or more. So, you know, franchise owners, fast food operators, they've all been sort of living in a dream world that they can basically push wages down as far as they can, despite everything. And it's really got to end.
And there's one more element to this I want to note before I let you go, Michael. You know, Fox News and its print media partners like the Wall Street Journal, New York Post, not to mention the California GOP, whose email list I have found myself on for some reason, and they are just inveterate liars. It's amazing. But they all really seem to have it out for Gavin Newsom. And they've been willing to, you know, to go all in with some extraordinary lies about him and that, you know, blame him for everything. Of course, this apocalypse of fast food in California. All of this suggests to me that they are really, really frightened of him on a national level, as he'll almost certainly be running for president, I suspect, in the not too distant future. Would you agree with that assessment that a lot of these attacks also are well, very convenient and helpful ways to try to attack Gavin Newsom.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of things at play here. First of all, yeah, sure. You know, Newsom sort of represents in the conservative right-wing mind the quintessential progressive political leader. But he also is, after all, the governor of California, and they love to bash California because, you know, they project an image of California as very, very liberal. And, it, you know, so it's been sort of a, you know, a target for the right wing for a few decades now. So here's Newsom, who's, you know, sort of well-groomed and well put together and expresses an extremely progressive worldview on climate change and global warming and things like that. So, yeah, he's naturally going to be a target. I think to his credit, he handles all that pretty well. You know, he doesn't shy away from his principles just because he's getting attacked by the likes of the Wall Street Journal.
Michael Hiltzik, I know that fact-checking these right-wing liars these days is more than a full-time job, so I'm very grateful that you took the time to rebut at least this one piece of nonsense that, like I said, you know, will likely become a zombie lie for years nonetheless, no matter what we do. But thank you for doing what you do and for joining us on the broadcast to explain it today. Michael Hiltzik is the Pulitzer Prize-winning business columnist at the L.A. Times. You can find his work there, latimes.com. You can find him on Twitter at HiltzikM. And you can find more about him and buy all of his books, by the way, at michaelhiltzik.com. Michael, great speaking with you, my friend. Look forward to the next time.
Okay, anytime.
Thank you. Okay, that's just, I can tell you now it's going to be a zombie lie. Oh, we can't raise for the wage for
any other
fast
state
food workers because it just wiped out the fast food industry in California. I can live here. I live here. I can tell you firsthand, no, the fast food industry is not being wiped out.
Yeah, it's
at
a lie.
Not by raising the minimum wage.
Yeah, those lies are going to be spreading and, like you said, zombie lies. So it's important for folks to understand that those are really just lies. And I think it's not surprising that Murdoch-owned media properties are really going all out.
Pumping it out, aren't
they?
Put
out some lies like that. It's really, really kind of shocking still.
And it is the double bonus because of Gavin Newsom. They know that, boy, that guy is presidential timber. And once he is ready to run, it could be very difficult for anyone to beat him.
And bashing,
in my opinion.
Yeah, and bashing him gets a lot of clicks, too.
All right, we got to get out. My thanks once again to Michael Hiltzik of the LA Times, to our producer, Desi Doyen, to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other that we've ever done since the beginning of time, you can download it for free anytime at bradblog.com. That is made possible by those of you who hit one of those donate buttons there, or just please go to bradblog.com/donate. Please consider signing up for a monthly donation of any amount you can afford. We could really use it right now. I know a lot of people have had to drop their subscriptions of late, you know, because of those $20 Big Macs. I understand.
That don't exist.
So
but yes.
Thanks in advance. Drop me an email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, you'll find me at TheBradBlog. See you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.